Network Europe, a program from Radio E, a partnership of Europe's international broadcasters.
In Network Europe today, what did Marco Materazzi tell Zinedine Zidane? What's the significance of the opening of the world's second largest oil pipeline? How the EU Commission has found a new role as super consumer watchdog, pitch black cafes in Prague, and rent-a-politician in Sweden. All coming up in this edition of Network Europe, now broadcast throughout Europe, around the world, and over the internet. At the helm today, I'm Mark Cummins. Thanks for joining the program. Now, a face may have once launched 1,000 ships, but this week, a headbutt has launched 100 times that many discussions on websites, news reports, and editorial columns. Why did French footballer Zidane headbutt Marco Materazzi in the chest? Since the incident during the World Cup finals last Sunday, rumours have run rife about what the Italian defender said to get what's been called an out-of-character reaction from the French midfielder. Newspapers and TV channels have even hired lip readers to find out, but they haven't been able to reach the same conclusion. In a TV appearance on Wednesday, Zidane said Materazzi insulted his mother and his sister, without giving any extra details. The star midfielder acknowledged that his gesture was inexcusable, but said that he had no regrets. The football ruling body FIFA has launched an investigation into the incident. In the meantime, Zidane's now notorious headbutt has inspired a light-hearted song, which is set to become the summer anthem in France this year. Radio France International's Nick Champeau reports from Paris. Attention, c'est la danse du coup de boule. Coup de boule à droite.
It's the headbutt dance. Zinedine Zidane's now notorious World Cup final headbutt, or coup de boule, was followed by a flurry of jokes circulating at fast speed on the internet. It has also inspired three friends, who own a small recording studio in Paris, to write a light-hearted song called Coup de Boule. We're in the studios of Emmanuel Lipsic and his brother Sébastien, and with Franck Lacombe, who sings on Coup de Boule.
It means the Italian, you know, had felt pain, first of all. Second of all, you know, Chirac spoke well. You know, that's we were very proud of it.
And, because he said, "I'm proud of your
yeah,
team."
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But you know, it was a light way to say it. You know, because there's a little African accent on the song, you know, that was meant to be. You know, just to put a little sunshine in the song. Mostly, the lyrics are about it's ironic. You know, just to say that we are the champion of the world, actually. I think of the sense of humor, because I think what Zidane did is not that bad. You know, it's only football, it's cool, you know, it's France. I mean, it's only between two men on a field, and that's it.
That's what you're saying. You're saying Zidane was expelled, Trezeguet missed his penalty, but we had a good time anyway.
Exactly.
And it looks like something big is going to happen to your studios and to this song. Do you think it's going to be an anthem this summer? In nightclubs, on the radio?
I mean, it's something that goes further than we could ever imagine, so I don't know. I mean, what happened will happen. If it's something that becomes an anthem, we'll be very proud of it. If it's not, we'll had a good time, and that's it.
Emmanuela, at the beginning it was just for fun, but it looks like you're going to make a lot of money out of this. We got here like 5 minutes ago and the phone keeps ringing all the time.
yes, it's true. It's funny.
So did music labels approach you? Did people offer you contracts to use the song?
Yes, we had several offers from music labels and a company that do ringtones.
For mobile phones?
Yeah. So we're just talking to them right now.
And do you think it's going to become the summer's anthem? Because in 1998, the World Cup anthem was I Will Survive. I think they sold like almost 1 million copies over that summer. Can you call your friend? Who's this?
It's Sébastien, it's my brother.
Okay, Sébastien. He's more optimistic.
Yeah.
You're Emmanuel's brother. You're involved also in the company.
Yeah, yeah. It's a song also, but no, I'm joking. I just think it's so funny to make a song for 50 friends. And when you make something for fun, it can go big. And when you try to make something big, sometimes you don't go nowhere.
And yeah, because there was a TV crew already here when we arrived, and I'm sure you have more interviews lined up.
Yeah, two TVs, it's crazy. And very good fun.
It's mostly good fun.
And if for fun you want to listen to the song again, check out the website www.laplagerecords.com. That's www.laplagerecords.com.
You're listening to Network Europe. On Thursday, leaders and representatives from more than 20 countries descended on Ceyhan, Turkey's main Mediterranean oil terminal. They are there for the official opening of the world's second longest oil pipeline. The 3 billion euro Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline runs from Azerbaijan via Georgia to Turkey and will deliver more than 1 million tons of oil a week to the world's markets. The oil comes from the Eurasian states of Kazakhstan and Azerbaijan. The region used to be part of the former Soviet Union, and that's why this pipeline is seen as having not only economic importance, but political as well. For the United States, one of the pipeline's main political backers, it's seen as a crucial step not only to unlocking urgently needed resources, but also to giving the energy-rich region greater independence from its former Russian master. Deutsche Welle's Dorian Jones reports from the Turkish capital, Istanbul.
The Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan, at an energy conference in Istanbul, declaring that the Baku-Tbilisi-Ceyhan pipeline will help to meet Europe's energy security needs for the 21st century. Turkey, which is a geographical bridge between Europe and the oil-rich countries of Eurasia, sees an opportunity to become a major player in the energy distribution game. The new pipeline will deliver 52 million tons of oil a year to the Turkish Mediterranean port of Ceyhan. Crucially, it avoids a volatile Middle East, giving the world markets an important alternative supply. But the pipeline also breaks Russia's monopoly on the distribution of energy for the former Soviet Union states. And that's vital, according to David Gorokova, head of the Georgian Gas and Oil Corporation.
The pipelines do not only bring energy security, they bring hope. Countries like us are not secured, despite the fact of Rose Revolution, new democracy. It's all going to die one day if there's no secure energy resources.
Last winter, Russia, without warning, doubled the price of energy to both Georgia and the Ukraine after pro-Russian administrations were ousted by mass protests. Russia claimed it was just charging market prices, but Washington blasted the move, accusing Moscow of strong-arm tactics. Both Democrat and Republican administrations have strongly backed the new pipeline as a means of breaking Moscow's iron grip on the region. Much to Moscow's anger, U.S. special forces have been sent to Georgia to help protect the pipeline, as the region is one of the most volatile in the world. A Russian jet taking off from a base in Armenia. Russia maintains a strong military presence in the Caucasus region, which the pipeline passes through. The region has an abundance of ethnic rivalries and unresolved conflicts. In Georgia, there are two breakaway states, which fought Georgian forces to a standstill in the 1990s. An uneasy ceasefire also exists between neighboring Armenia and Azerbaijan. Tatiana Matrova, an energy security expert and advisor to the Russian presidency, warns that U.S.-Russian rivalry in the region could have far-reaching consequences.
This region, it has always been volatile, if you look in the history, and it still is, and there is a very big potential for future conflicts. I'm afraid that as the whole political tension is getting stronger and stronger, tension in this region will also rise.
The success of the BTC pipeline ultimately depends on the stability of one of the world's most volatile regions. Without stability, the long-term dream of Turkey and the U.S. of opening up a secure east-west energy corridor that exports oil and gas and imports independence and security to former Soviet states, will remain just that, a dream.
Deutsche Welle's Dorian Jones with a picture of the changing face of Europe's eastern neighbours. Now, neighbours is what the Finns and the Estonians have been for centuries, but it's only been since the fall of the Iron Curtain that the two countries have begun to reacquaint themselves. But for Estonia, as the borders come down and people, goods and services flow freely back and forth from Finland, the problem of brain drain has leapt onto the political agenda. Radio Polonia's Michal Zajac has this report from Tallinn.
I'm standing inside of the building of the A passenger terminal of the port in Tallinn. It seems to be quite a busy port, especially at this time as we are approaching the departure of the Super Sea Cat ferry to Helsinki. More and more people are gathering. And they have quite a lot of options to travel to Helsinki, at least 8 ferries a day. You can also travel by helicopter, which will take you from the center of Tallinn to the center of Helsinki in less than 20 minutes. Of course, it's much more expensive. Kalev is here with me. He's an Estonian man living in Estonia, working also in Estonia, but for a Finnish company. Now he's about to board the ferry to Helsinki for a business trip.
Yes, now I am working for a Finnish company. It's a consulting company in energy area.
So I guess that your friends who work in Finland are satisfied.
Yes, most of them say that they go to Finland just to earn money. And that's the reason, a short time to go for a year or 2 years.
Kalev is just one of many Estonians who can directly enjoy the Finnish presence in his country. More Finnish companies are attracted to the local market, while travelling between the two states has never been easier, not to mention ethnic and language bonds. Marko Mikkelson, Estonian MP representing the Conservative Party, believes that Estonia owes much to Finland, especially for its assistance on its way to democratic reforms of the 1990s.
We are very natural partners, and this very strong partnership between Estonia and Finland started immediately after we gained our independence in 1991, and mainly due to support of Finland trade and business contacts, Estonia got very good start for our reforms early 90s.
Up till now, Ireland has been the number one destination of Estonians looking for better lives abroad, as its labour market was accessible to EU newcomers on day one of enlargement. With Finland being the next best choice, the situation may soon change, following Finland's opening of its labour market too. Estonian MP Marko Mikkelson says that despite clear advantages of open access to the Finnish labour market, the government in Estonia is aware that now more effort is needed to convince Estonians to stay in the country.
Now labour market is open, is actually creating much better situation for Finnish businesses who can now legally hire people from Estonia if necessary. I think that this is the normal way how European Union should work. If we are declaring the four freedoms, this is part of it. Of course, this creates problems in Estonia to make our society more competitive, that people won't leave. But Estonians, even we have quite good statistics in that, people coming back.
There are those who say, however, that the Estonian government may be putting on a brave face while privately having worries about the extent to which the booming Finnish economy might suck out local talent, especially that the two Ugro-Finnish languages are mutually intelligible. They are well aware that Lithuania, another Baltic state, is already experiencing serious shortages on its labour market after too many specialists and skilled labourers just upped and left for Ireland.
Radio Polonia's Michal Zajac with that report. Now it seems as if the European Commission has found itself a new role. Stephen Castle in Brussels has the details.
In some parts of the continent, the European Commission is seen as a bastion of free market liberalism, always pushing the interests of industry. But this week, the Commission's top politicians have been taking on big business and standing up to some of the world's largest corporations. The Commission President, José Manuel Barroso, launched plans to force mobile phone operators to slash the cost for calls made abroad but inside the EU. Meanwhile, his competition commissioner, Neelie Kroes, was doing battle with the world's biggest software maker, Microsoft. Ms. Kroes, who is Europe's most senior regulator, imposed her second massive fine on the corporation. The message from the Commission is a robust one. It promotes free markets, but insists they must operate fairly. And Mr. Barroso sees a growing role for himself as champion of the European consumer. The mobile phone issue is a good case. Operators charge massive markups on those who make calls on foreign networks, what's known in the jargon as roaming. The Irish government has already acted after its foreign minister found himself a victim. Dermot Ahern lives 5 miles south of Ireland's border with the UK. In the sitting room of his home, he could make calls on his normal Vodafone Ireland service relatively cheaply. But when he moved to his kitchen, his network would change and his phone bills would mount. That's the thing of the past in Ireland. Consumers there now pay the same tariff north and south of the Irish border. The rest of Europe will not see the complete scrapping of roaming fees. But the proposals outlined by Mr. Barroso and his Information Commissioner Vivian Reding could see prices cut by up to 70%, providing governments and MEPs back the plan. Meanwhile, Ms. Kroes was imposing a massive fine of €280.5 million on Microsoft. This follows the record €497 million punishment meted out to the software giant in March 2004. The case is complex, but hinges on a ruling that Microsoft has abused its dominant position in the market to squeeze out rivals. Now the US corporation has failed to follow instructions to make technical information public so rivals can create products that work with the ubiquitous Windows system. The emphasis on these cases is not a coincidence. With ambitious plans for a European constitution on hold, Mr. Barroso is concentrating on bread and butter issues relevant to citizens. He wants the Commission to be seen as an effective regulator and as a guardian of consumer rights. This more practical approach from the Commission may be paying off. A survey of public opinion across the continent has shown a rise of 5 points in the EU's approval rating, up to 55%. Mr. Barroso may be right in believing that Europeans worry more about the cost of their calls than the future of their constitution.
Next to the Czech Republic, where an organisation that helps the blind stage an event at the Karlovy Vary Film Festival that's just come to a close. The aim was to bring visitors closer to the life of the visually impaired. Dita Asiedu reports on the country's first ever pitch black cafe.
The Czech pop idol Aneta Langerová has been enjoying quite a bit of success here in the Czech Republic, and she's been using it for a good cause. She staged an open-air concert during the Karlovy Vary Film Festival, to which she invited a number of special guests, young, talented singers who've not been able to make it in the music scene because they are blind. The concert was in support of a Czech radio project called Svetluška. And next to me now is Martina Kaderková, one of the coordinators of the project, to tell us a little bit more about it.
Well, Czech Radio Foundation has a special project which is called Svetluška. I can try to translate it. It's a firefly. And we finance various special aids for blind people, like speaking computers and optical aids and guiding dogs and different courses, and we support young talented musicians.
Now we're standing next to a cafe that's actually quite unique here. Could you explain to us what it is?
Well, it's first cafe in the dark, which was opened in the Czech Republic. Inside the cafeteria is absolute darkness, and we have 10 blind staff who actually makes espresso in complete darkness and who guides the visitors of the cafeteria to their tables and who serves the cafe.
And the main aim of this cafe is to understand what it's like to be blind.
It's actually about exchange of the roles, because inside it is the blind guide who you have to rely on. Outside, the blind often have to rely on us when we help them to cross the street or in other situation.
Is the interior a little bit different than normal cafes?
Yeah, of course. each alphabet in Braille has 6 dots, and you use different combinations. And in our cafe in the dark, we have 6 tables. There's a main line where only the 2 blind waitresses move, so you cannot really cross their path, but it's nice. And we would like to bring this project to Prague and Brno, definitely. And we are also thinking about opening Cafe in the Dark in Prague, perhaps, which would be permanent. So it would give actually employment possibilities, because there's, well, 75% unemployment among visually impaired.
Okay, and the time has come for me to try it out. I've been asked to put my watch and cell phone into my bag just to be sure that there's absolutely no light in the cafe. And Marketa is just about to show me to my table. So here we go. Okay, my guide is now holding my hand and showing me which way to go. I must admit, I'm a little bit nervous because it's pitch black in here and I have absolutely no idea what is in front of me, what's behind me. Okay, I'm supposed to turn left now. And it seems like I'm already here at my table.
Tak se prosím posaďte. Za chvilinku za váma přijde číšník, ten se vás obslouží. Ano.
Dobře.
Ano, vydržte.
Okay, Marketa has said goodbye and I have been asked to wait for my waiter. Now, I gotta tell you, it's really strange because there's music playing in the background, but it still seems to me like it's extremely loud in here. And I wonder whether it's just my sense of hearing making up for the fact that I can't see.
I'm Matthew.
Hello, I'm Dieter.
Would you like something to drink?
One water without bubbles, please.
Okay. Wait a minute, please.
Okay. Have you been enjoying yourselves in here?
Yeah.
Tell me, did it take you long to get used to the darkness?
Yeah, the first 5 minutes and getting to the table.
And do you think that you're going to come back again to this cafe?
Yeah, for sure. If they build something in Prague, something similar like this, I think I'll go there. Because it's really fun, you can really enjoy, and you can also support some good things.
Now, you usually go to your library to borrow a book. But how about borrowing a human being instead? Maybe an obese person, a bouncer, a Muslim, or why not even a politician? Then you should head to the Swedish Travelling Exhibition's Prejudice Library. Radio Sweden's Azaria Kiros has been there.
Oh, it's a fun project, and serious at the same time. It all started a number of years ago as part of a grant plan to fight prejudices, racial, religious, and others. For instance, what are your thoughts about the bouncer who tells you that the disco is full and spreads his body across the door to keep you out? Or how do you react when you see an obese person walk past you? In that case, how would you like to sit down and talk to that person instead of going around with your prejudices about overweight people? Welcome to the Prejudice Library, where you can borrow all sorts of people. But how does one go about it? Lena Ahtola is a coordinator at the Swedish Travelling Exhibition.
You just come to the library and we talk to you, and then you get to sit down. So we bring people in our library and you can sit down with someone and talk to them.
If I have a prejudice, say, about a priest, how would that help me if I sit down and talk to him? How would I be able to understand him or her better?
We think that prejudice, that is about that you have an image that maybe is not grounded in your own experience, but instead that you have heard something or have read something about a group. But when you meet a person, an individual, you get to hear his or her experiences, his or her values and beliefs, and that makes a connection, we think. That makes it easier to understand. We don't say that you can get rid of all prejudice or that you can understand everything, but at least you get to hear it from a person and not just something you have heard from someone else.
And there was a long queue of people waiting for their turn to borrow the person offered for loan the day I visited the travelling exhibition. And the person on loan? A politician.
Hej, välkomna. Vi får låna en politiker. Det här är Riksutställningars fördomsbibliotek.
How many of us don't go around with all sorts of prejudices about our politicians? But how often have we had the possibility to meet the person behind the political veneer and sit down and discuss not only politics, but also personal matters? And that was what the visitors did. But before they left the library, they had to succumb to a one-question test. They have to identify the political colour of the politician they met. And that is not an easy task. Bjorni Saxon was one of those who took the opportunity to sit down for a 15-minute session with a politician. What did he think of the meeting?
Well, it was actually a new experience. I have never been able to talk to a politician who actually are able not to tell her values from the beginning.
But could you see the person behind the politician?
Yeah, of course. And that was very interesting, because there were no prejudices, there were no walls between us.
And did you succeed in guessing what sort of politician she was?
No, but almost. It was very hard.
The politician who talked to Bjorn Isaksson was Lena Lagerfeld. How did she feel about the encounter?
It was marvelous. It was my first here, and it was really inspiring to see how interested he was. And he put me in difficult situations, because he really spoke from his personal point of view with very specific problems, which I sort of, you know, had to solve or give my opinion on. And yeah, it was one of the best conversations I've had so far this week, actually. He explained to me how he was thinking when he was trying to decide what party I was in. He was juggling with the, like, 2 and 3 of them, so he was not sure and all. And that proves to me that many people don't really know all about my party, which is interesting. They don't really know if we're left or right, and we have positioned ourselves like in the middle, so it's good. We also have some things in common with the party he chose.
So, what can we expect next in the Prejudice Library? Lena Hattula, the project coordinator at the Swedish Travelling Exhibition.
Two prejudices that we haven't been able yet to get is a bimbo, and also an ordinary Swedish male heterosexual man in the middle age. That is also a request that we have had a lot of times, and that we will have to try to get someone.
And you know what? The whole project looked so exciting, I couldn't help asking Lena Ahtola one very last question.
Do I look borrowable to you?
Yes, I would think so. Absolutely. And also we'll be thinking about borrow a journalist, because that is also something people are prejudiced about.
Keep me in mind.
Yes, yes, we will.
Zari Kuras from Radio Sweden there with more good reasons to visit a library. Rounding off this edition of Network Europe. This program is a partnership of Radio France International, Radio Sweden, Radio Polonia, Deutsche Welle, Radio Netherlands, Radio Romania International, Radio Slovakia, Radio Prague and Radio Ukraine. Here at Network Europe, we really do enjoy reading feedback. You can send your comments or questions to us at contact@networkeurope.org. That's contact@networkeurope.org. I'll leave you in the capable hands of La Page with the Headbutt Dance. Network Europe will be back next week. On behalf of our pan-European team, this is Mark Cummins. Thanks for joining us.
Quand même bien rigolé.
Zidane l'a frappé, Zidane l'a tapé. Zidane l'a frappé, Zidane l'a tapé. Zidane l'a frappé, Zidane l'a tapé. Zidane l'a frappé, Zidane l'a tapé.
Trezeguet n'a pas joué.
Quand il a joué, il a raté.
Il a tout fait capoter.
La coupe, on l'a raté.
Martès n'a rien arrêté.
C'est pourtant pas compliqué.
Les sponsors sont tous fâchés.
Chirac a bien parlé. Zidane l'a frappé. Zidane l'a tapé. Zidane l'a frappé. Zidane l'a tapé. Zidane l'a frappé. Zidane l'a tapé. Zidane l'a frappé. Zidane l'a tapé.
Attention, c'est la danse du coup de boule.
Coup de boule, coup de boule.
Coup de boule à droite.
Coup de boule, coup de boule.
Coup de boule à gauche.
Coup de boule, coup de boule.
Coup de boule avant.
Coup de boule, coup de boule.
vocabulario. E mette una penalty, attenzione, il mattino. Ah!